Well, next study, Baptists and the American Frontier. I've always been fascinated by the story of the American Frontier, and I've been fascinated by Baptist history and Christian history, and so that all sort of comes together in this. This is from a commentary on the preaching of Shubal Stearns, very, very influential man we'll see in a bit. Pungent words and homely illustrations made vividly clear some of the profoundest religious ideas. Strong gestures and a fervent plea told the people the preacher was more intently involved in his message. This is one of the keys to effective, proper, popular, biblical preaching. Is that you're emotional. You have some emotion about what you're preaching on, what you're saying, what you're teaching. Too many sermons. These are number two complaints that come about sermons in independent Baptist churches. You don't understand what the guy said, or he doesn't seem to care whether it matters very much. Okay. But if you can say it in such a fashion that it can be understood, and I consider that one of the most important things I ever do, whatever the setting is on who I'm going to preach to make the message, somebody said, put the cookies on the bottom shelf where the children can get them. Okay. Is to get the message understood. That's why I tell folks the scariest preaching I've ever done. For many years, my wife was a kindergarten teacher in a school that had two kindergarten classes. And I would get invited a couple times a year to preach in kindergarten chapel. And so that scares me more than speaking at the Grace Conference, because I've got to get the message down to kindergarten level. And I'm more confident that I can do it on adult level. Kindergarten level takes more work and more time and more thought process and so forth to get it down. But I have responsibility when I walked into kindergarten chapel and preach to the kindergartners so that they can understand. For some strange reason, they never invite me to preach at kindergarten chapel at Ravenswood. I don't know what that is. I've got to talk to them about that. We have it. I've never been in it. But you have to preach to the audience that's there, and you have to feel something about your message if you want people to feel something about it. And Shubal Stearns apparently had that ability to preach, and people believed he meant it. The atheist economist, Ayn Rand, and I'm not recommending her, but she said something was interesting. Somebody asked her about doing her biography. She said, take all my nonfiction books, put them together, and put at the end, and she meant it. She said, that would be my biography. And that's a pretty good thing for a preacher. If you could honestly say at the end of a sermon, he meant that. Well, Stearns had that reputation. Well, Pilgrims, Puritans, and Baptists. The famous Pilgrims espoused many ideas, even though they were not Baptists. Okay? They taught sole authority of Scripture, the priesthood of believers, separation of church and state, soul liberty, independent churches, and the concept of a regenerated church membership. So you look at that list, what did they leave out? What? No, that's one of the fundamentals. We're talking here that they believed all the fundamentals. And if you go back to the beginning of the class, they're fundamentals and the Baptist distinctives. What's the Baptist distinctive? Two ordinances. And it wasn't so much the Lord's Supper that there would be a difference on. The idea of baptism by immersion of believers only. They did not grasp that as a group. Okay? And various people have looked at it, and you find pilgrims preaching things that are Baptist distinctives, whole sermons on things that are Baptist distinctives. And said that some folks have looked at them as part of Baptist heritage, and they did promote some of these doctrinal ideas, but they weren't really Baptist. Okay? If you're sprinkling babies, let's be clear, you're not a Baptist, no matter what else you're doing. Well, they came to the New World for express purpose of being free to worship as they chose. For the express purpose of being free to worship as they chose. And they endured the hardships of the wilderness for an opportunity to practice religious freedom. to practice religious freedom. In that day, that era, why do you come across an ocean? To brave a wilderness. When you first arrive, what do you have? You don't have any place to sleep. You have to build your place to sleep. You have to build everything you've got. You've got nothing. You've got weather that, while not always harsh, is sometimes harsh. You imagine living in a cabin through the winter we just had. Okay? You have to plant your own crops, and it's a limited area. If you're in England and a crop fails in this region, what do? You go buy food in another region. If you're braving the wilderness and planting crops and a crop fails, where do you go? You can hunt, but wild animals don't actually invite you to come up to them and shoot them. They either effective at running or fighting back. Okay? Many a person went out, saw a bear, and thought, bear skin rug, bear bacon, bear steaks, and they found out there was a whole lot more to the story than that. Because they will rip you to pieces if you don't know how to hunt them and hunt them quickly. The Indians? Indians were not a large population, and it was huge amounts of land they did not use, which is fine. You could go somewhere where there wasn't an Indian tribe living. That wasn't hard. And virtually all the early settlements, they did that on purpose. They went somewhere where there wasn't an Indian tribe close. However, the Indian tribes all believed it was honorable to steal from anybody that wasn't in their tribe, which meant you were constantly dealing with armed raiders who had become very effective fighters in the circumstances in which they lived. The thing, people look at this and, you know, we just moved from coast to coast. The Indians, while winning a few battles, lose all the wars. But the reason they lost all the wars was we had better technology, not because they were not ferocious fighters. And we did have better technology, and you could shoot somebody with a musket at a greater distance than they could hit you with an arrow. Okay? From the beginning, we had better technology. And it's that better technology that leads to the defeat of the Indians. And that and the fact the Indian tribes never thought of themselves as Indians. They were the Cherokee, the Shawnee, the Wyandot. They all considered themselves separate nations. They'd sometimes form allegiances. A couple of leaders, like Pontiac and Tecumseh, tried to unite them all, but they were never united. In fact, in almost all of the wars, it was the white man and certain Indian tribes against certain other Indian tribes. And you know who wins that? Okay? Not every battle, but they win the wars because of all that. So why would you come into that when on any given day, you did not know if there was going to be a freezing snow that you were not protected from, wild Indians attacking you, inability to catch something in hunting. In those days, you could not store much of your meat long term. So you didn't just have to be successful hunting last week. You need to be successful hunting this week. And, you know, you might have nice weather and it's a good time for a hunt and everything goes well, but the week that there's, you know, 4 feet of snow and bitter cold, you also have to be successful hunting if you were going to have meat that week. Now, there are some things they could do to keep meat for a period of time. There are ways to fix bacon and so forth. But for the most part, you didn't just hunt and then go back to hunt months later. You hunted and hunted and hunted and hunted. And being out on the hunt exposed you to the Indians more than sitting in a fort did. Had to build your first house and the furniture that went in it. So why in the world do you cross a wilderness to go through all this? They wanted to be free. Some colonists came for economic freedom. The pilgrims came for religious freedom. But all these folks came to be free. And they considered their freedom worth the risk. Well, endured the hardships of the wilderness for an opportunity to practice religious freedom. The area in which the pilgrims were not Baptist was their understanding of the doctrine of baptism. The doctrine of baptism. Most of them accepted the ideas of infant baptism and sprinkling. Infant baptism and sprinkling. You see on tombstones for some of the babies that could not survive in the conditions of the wilderness, their birth date, their baptism date, and their death date. And even though they only lived for a few weeks, you got a baptism date. And by the way, we're really about to get into this here. Imagine this concept, this difficulty. You believe in separation of church and state. So you don't want any government telling people what they can believe. So you have this area. You believe in separation of church and state, absolute religious freedom. So who moves into an area where there's absolute religious freedom? Everybody, including the people demanding a state church. Because you believe in freedom, you allow the people to come who believe in taking away that freedom. And so then that what becomes the risk? The very people that came there because of the freedom you provided then become the threat to your freedom. And so this was debated, and some said, well, we need to have laws that say if you believe in a state church, you can't come here. But if you have that law, what have you done away with? Religious freedom. I mean, it was a difficult situation they found themselves in. Well, from the pilgrims, however, came a number of people who study the scriptures, led them to become Baptists. I read just the other day that the second pastor in the Plymouth colony started teaching baptism by immersion, and that's why he got voted out of the pastorate. Hey, Francis Cook, C-O-O-K-E, one of the original passengers on the Mayflower, became a Baptist preacher. This was after the establishment of a Baptist colony in Rhode Island. Cook moved to the Dartmouth area and started a Baptist church. The pilgrims upheld his religious liberty, and several of them joined his church. Baptists liked to go to the pilgrim area because there was religious liberty. They could start a church. They were no threat to the pilgrims. However, that's not how the story ends. As the Puritans settled all around the pilgrims and began to come over, these were folks who wanted a purified state church, settled all around the pilgrims, they brought their idea of a state church with them. And they come there because they want to be free to promote their idea of a purified state church. But in promoting a purified state church, they become the threat to the original people who made it possible for them to come there and have religious freedom. They soon begin to harass the Baptists and other nonconformists. The independent English preacher, Roger Williams, fled the persecution of William Laud and came to the village of Salem, Massachusetts, where he became the pastor of the church there. Two of his teachings angered the Puritans. First, he taught the complete separation of church and state, and secondly, he urged the conversion of the Indians. He said, God brought us here for a reason. There are these folks here that don't know Christ. They don't have churches. They don't have a Bible. God brought us here to win them to the Lord. Why do you think the Puritans opposed that? Well, they weren't English. That's part of it. They saw the wickedness of the Indian tribal culture. Today, the Indian tribal culture is almost worshipped in the United States. But it was wicked and ungodly. Okay? And they saw that, and they began to look at these as people who have no souls. Roger Williams was correct. It's not that they didn't have souls. They didn't have a Bible. They didn't have the gospel. It doesn't matter where you go. The original Celtic inhabitants of England, for example, before Christianity came to them, people without Bible, people without the gospel, people without churches, live ungodly and wickedly. You want an illustration of it? Doesn't matter what their color is. Go to the inner cities of any major city in the United States, where while they have plenty of churches, they don't have gospel preaching churches, and they don't have churches that honor the Bible. What do you get? Communities you don't want to walk through at night by yourself. Okay? William, the problem Indians have is the gospel is not there. When I, he was soon banished from New England, finishes a paragraph. He was soon banished from New England. I pastored in Marion, Indiana for my second pastorate. And they had in Marion, Indiana, a celebration every year called Missinawa, as a name of river. And there was a major battle in the War of 1812 fought along the Missinawa River. And so every year they have a reenactment of the battle, and there's all kinds of people that come and camp out, and reenactors and booths and different kinds of food and candy. People will roast deer, and you can get venison, you know, directly off the fire, and all kinds of things. And we would go there, and when we lived there every year, it was a fun day. But I'm driving out to, they ran buses and shuttles, but one year we decided to take a picnic lunch and not ride a shuttle. So we're driving. And the little maps you could get in town, you drive out to the spot, and you turn left at Indian Village Baptist Church corner. Well, that was intriguing. So we get to the corner. We'd gone there on a bus but never noticed. Get to the corner, and you could see tombstones over there. So we stopped, and we went out. And the names on the tombstones were pretty worn. I'm afraid they're probably worn out now completely, but the biggest tombstone, on it says, Mashinga Misha, who's a character in the battle. He's a war chief of the Miami Indians. But on his tombstone it says, and Indians didn't bury with tombstones, but he got a tombstone. On a tombstone it says, Mashinga Misha, Baptist deacon and faithful servant of Jesus Christ. Really? You know, somehow that doesn't get mentioned during the reenactment. And so we go around, and there's all these tombstones, and then there's the foundation of a church building, a little plaque. It says, on this location was where the Indian Village Baptist Church was. So I got fascinated by that and began to go to Grant County historical records, and I'll find out everything I could about the church, and it's really quite a story. Miami Indians were very warlike, so warlike that the United States government would not allow preachers and missionaries to go to them. They said, you'll just get killed. So it was against the law to go to them. Isaac McCoy, famous as a missionary to the Indians, had preaching stations among several tribes, and he tried to have preaching stations among the Miami, but the government would shut him down. Oh, their church is praying for the Miami Indians. And very famous story of Frances Slocum, big multicultural story. She's a multicultural hero today. As a little girl, she got kidnapped by the Delaware Indians who sold her to the Miami Indians. When they signed a peace treaty years later that required the Miami Indians to surrender all their captives, she was an adult woman by that time, and she refused to leave. She chose to stay with the Indians. And so she's a big hero today because she chose Indian life over returning back to the white man. School named after, park named after, yearly celebration named after because she chose the Indian life, and so she's a hero. Here's a part of the story they don't tell. As she got older, part of the treaty, they gave 160 acres to every Indian man. You don't hear usually that in the story. And they gave the chiefs 500 acres. So they could all have a pretty significant sized farm. Well, as she got older and her husband died, she has 500 acres. She contacts her white family back in New England. And she has family members in a church where they're praying that God will open a door to the Miami Indians. And she said, I don't want to leave this land, but if one of my family, she didn't have any children, one of my family will come help me farm this land, the land will be theirs when I die. Well, 500 acres is a pretty good deal. But in a Baptist church that had been praying for a door open to the Miami Indians, there was a young man who was her nephew. And he said, made the arrangement that he would go out and farm this land for her, and then one day it would be his. He gets on the Miami reservation, this Baptist man gets on the Miami reservation when no preacher's allowed to go there. And you know what he does when he gets on a reservation? He starts witnessing to people. He's living there. He starts witnessing to people, starts gathering people together for Sunday church services. And at some point in this process, Mashingo Misha, the war chief, this is after that battle in 1812, Mashingo Misha, the war chief, gets saved. When he gets saved, he comes forward and says, I kept a white captive. And he returns her to her family. And she testifies to this, said that she was terrified every night. She'd huddle in the corner of the cabin in which they lived with a buffalo robe over her, because says the spirits would come and talk to him every night, and she'd hear them. When he got saved, they quit coming. And she set him free. He set her free. And then the stories told in the old records is in the old newspapers. Mashingo Misha became a leader in organizing that group into a church. And he actually had a cart ministry. The cabins were spread along the Mississinewa River, and he would take a cart on Sunday morning, drive the cart down the river, picking up and drive. He actually drove it down and then came back. And on the way back, he would pick up anybody that wanted to ride to church. And he would bring people to the church every Sunday. And a lot of things came out of it. They sent missionaries to the Wyandotte Indians, and They had a government-run school on the reservation, and they didn't like what the government-run school teacher was teaching, so they sent him back, and they started a Christian school, the Indian Village Baptist Church Christian School. And they conducted the school for years and years. And what happened, they had a flourishing church. And this was amazing to me. I began to tell this story to the church I was pastoring, Emmanuel Baptist Church in Marion. And some of the older members were Miami Indians, and they knew the story. I didn't even know they were Miami Indians. They said what happened was many of the Indians didn't like farming, so they sold. Said you could get a pretty good amount of money for 160 acres. They sold them and moved into the town of Marion and started businesses and things. And when they did, so many of the members of the Indian Village Baptist Church had moved to Marion. The Indian Village Baptist Church started a church for them. And that was the very church I was pastoring, had been started by the Indian Village Baptist Church. And the early members were all Miami Indians. It was an old church too. It went back to the 1800s. But some of them knew because they'd heard the story from their grandparents. And one of the ladies in our church, she was 89, had gotten saved when she was 12 in the Indian Village Baptist Church. And she was never a member. She was not a Miami Indian. But they were having a youth rally at the church, and several churches went together at the Indian Village. And she was saved in a youth rally at the Indian Village Baptist Church. And that's a whole lot better deal than what the Puritans want. You know what happened when you preached the gospel to those people? Some of them got saved. And some of them grew in the Lord. And as they got saved and grew in the Lord, they weren't like the Miami Indians that are portrayed in the Battle of Mississinewa, which is an accurate presentation for the time, except for one thing. The politically correct day and age in which we live, in the reenactment, they have to let the Indians win every other reenactment, because it's politically incorrect to have the white people win all the time just because they actually won in a real battle. So that always irritates me when I'm there and the Indians win, because that's not what happened in real life. But every other battle, they do four reenactments a year, and every other battle they have to let the Indians win in spite of what happened historically. But what happens when you put the gospel in front of people? We're all the same. We all have the same sin nature. But what happens when people get saved? They'll have the same new nature. And Roger Williams was exactly right. You realize all the trouble that could have been skipped if you took the gospel to the Indians first? Illustrating the same principle many other ways. I've collected information on this stuff for years and wanted to write a book about it. Never got to it yet, anyway. But the Sioux Indians, you know, folks that wiped out Custer. One missionary went to the Sioux Indians and he spent 64 years translating the Bible into the Sioux language. 64 years. Dies before it's quite finished and his son finishes it. The Bible translated, it's printed, and it's spread among the Sioux. And the official Sioux history says that it was the distribution of that Bible that turned the Sioux away from their warlike behavior. In other words, what Custer could not do, the Bible did do. And you continue to read, and it fascinates me, Quanah Parker, famous war chief of the Comanches. His mother was actually stolen by the Comanches as a young woman, teenager. His father was a prominent, her grandfather was a prominent Baptist preacher. Her father was a prominent Baptist preacher, and so were some of her brothers. She got kidnapped and not recovered until she was grown, and by the time she was grown, she had children. And she was sort of recovered away from them, and Quanah Parker was the war chief of the Comanches, famous for his ability to coordinate charges and all that kind of thing. And for years, he's the scourge of the West. When the Comanches are finally defeated and all given property the same way other Indian tribes were, and that story doesn't get told today, he sells the property, buys a house in town, and starts going to the local Methodist church. Gets saved, gets baptized, and he becomes the director of their yearly missions conference. That's what Quanah Parker's doing at the end of his life. He's directing a yearly missions conference. And not the scourge of the West anymore. Then Geronimo, whose greatest claim to fame was his ability to slip up to people and cut their throat without them even knowing anybody was there. Most people don't tell the last chapter of Geronimo's story. After he's finally captured, they send him to prison in St. Augustine, Florida. The old Fort Augustine had been turned into prison. Geronimo gets saved. Totally transformed. And they start letting him out on Sundays. To sign out on Sundays to go give his testimony in churches. And it became a huge deal to have Geronimo in your church giving his testimony. Huge crowds would come, and there are records of a lot of flyers that were printed up as far back as that was, early 1900s. Because, I mean, if you had Geronimo at your church Sunday morning, you had a crowd. And they trusted him so much, they let him go without a guard. You just, somebody from a church just come pick him up, and you take him, and he gives his testimony and all that kind of thing. And nobody was afraid of him. Gospel transformed him. Quanah Parker actually gets kicked out of the church in his elderly years for gambling. He was an unrepentant gambler. And he gets removed from the church membership, which has something about the standards for church membership they had compared to the standards of church membership that we had. But even after he got expelled from the church membership, he continued to attend. He also continued to gamble, but he continued to attend. When you took the gospel there, and that'll be illustrated a couple more times here before we get done. Well, Williams gained permission from Charles II to establish a colony where religious freedom would be guaranteed to everyone. Guaranteed to everyone. This became the Rhode Island colony. This was really an experiment on the part of Charles II. A settlement was begun at Providence upon land, notice the next few words, purchased from the Indians. They're never attacked. You know why they're not attacked? They purchased the land from the nearby Indian tribes, everybody they thought might have a claim to it. A number of Baptists fled there for personal safety, and Williams became convinced that their teaching on baptism was correct. He was baptized by one of them, and soon he baptized 10 others. However, within 3 months, he renounced his identification as a Baptist and became an independent again. He often said that Baptists were the closest to New Testament churches, but that no true New Testament church continued to exist. Williams continued to promote the Rhode Island colony and negotiate with both the English government and Indians. He had more success with the Indians than any other colonial leader. He defended separation of church and state in many important publications. The Puritans wished to militarily destroy the Rhode Island colony, but they could not because of the royal charter secured by Williams. He had gotten the king's permission to do this. So when the Puritans would love to have attacked them, attacking them would have put them in direct conflict with the king. The first real continuing Baptist church in America was founded by John Clark. People debate over who founded the first Baptist church in what's now the United States, Roger Williams or John Clark. Well, the church Williams founded was not Baptist for very long, and it's probably not a good reason to count it. The first real continuing Baptist church in America was founded by John Clark. He's often remembered as the father of American Baptists. Ironically enough, just in the last few years, that church has taken the name Baptist off its door. It's been modernist for a while, tragically. But the church still exists. He was both a leader in the Rhode Island colony and a church builder and planner. Once he and two other members of his church were visiting an aged church member who lived under the jurisdiction of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The men were arrested and ordered to pay fines. But one of his members, Obadiah Holmes. Refused to pay the fine and was publicly whipped. By the way, there is a movie on Obadiah Holmes' experience produced by a Baptist church in Michigan, fairly widely spread. Parts of the movie are very good and moving, and the retelling of what actually happened to Obadiah Holmes is very good. I must confess the movie irritates me because it has a scene of a Baptist preacher being burned at the stake, and that never happened in the colonies. King James had put an end to that in 1612. That just never happened in the colonies. I have communicated with them about that, and they just said it was dramatic license. And I'm not a fan of dramatic license when you're telling a historical story. But the part about Obadiah Holmes is worth watching. And I'm sorry they put the other part in there. This caused Henry Dunster, D-U-N-S-T-E-R, he saw Holmes get whipped. Because Henry Dunster, first president of Harvard, which was the first American college, to study the Baptist positions. Dunster wanted to know why Holmes was willing to undergo persecution for the cause of believers' baptism. Why was this such a big deal? And that's a question you have to answer today, especially in Michigan. Why is this such a big deal? Because God commanded it. The issue, the big deal is not the water. The big deal is that God commanded it. And the Bible is the only authority. So if the Bible tells you to do something and the state tells you not to do it, who's the higher authority? The Bible. Always. His study convinced him of the truth of believers' baptism. When he expressed this, he was dismissed from Harvard. Here's a good trivia question someday. Why was the first president of Harvard fired? For believing in believers' baptism. Shall we say Harvard has long not been a friend of the truth. Obadiah Holmes later succeeded John Clark as pastor of the Baptist Church in Newport, Rhode Island. Back in the state, when I was in the state of Florida, and we fought a 5-year battle with the state of Florida. Same kind of battle that's all over the place in the states now, but we fought a 5-year battle. And I had no more than gotten to Florida, and they passed a law that said that Bible colleges, you could not use the name college if you didn't have so much secular material in your curriculum. Long story short, we were arguing about that, and they kept saying, well, all you've got to do is change your name. I said, look, Harvard was originally a Bible college. Okay? The first college in America was a Bible college. And I said, look, if all we ever had to do was change our name one time, we'd probably do it just for the sake of not having a problem. But I said, as soon as we take a new name, you're going to want that one too. She said, well, we have to own the name college because we might not like what you folks do with the college. I said, college is our name. You stole it from us. And as a matter of fact, I don't like what you're doing with it. Why don't you guys get another name? They were not impressed by that, but we did win that battle. But that's another story for maybe tomorrow. God bless you all. Take a break.